Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Hi, welcome to Central Line. I'm Dr. Adam Stryker, your host and editor. Today, we're going to talk about a very important topic, opioid addiction. I have the honor of welcoming three guests to today's show, starting with a doctor and mother whose story will move you. Welcome to the show, Dr. Milas.
Hi, my name is Bonnie Milas. I'm a professor of anesthesiology at the University of Pennsylvania. My area of expertise is cardiac surgery. I tragically have lost two adult sons to the opioid epidemic due to overdose. I have no remaining children. I am deeply committed to reducing stigma associated with opioid use disorder and saving lives resulting from opioid overdoses.
Dr. Milas, obviously you've given so much to this cause already, and I know it's just incredibly brave that you've joined us today to share with us your story and your insights. And so thank you so much for joining. And we also have joining with us today, Dr. Dahl.
Hi there. My name is Armand Dahl. And I'm a professor of anesthesiology at University of Washington. I work at the Harborview Medical Center, which is a level one trauma center in the Washington state. And I'm also a member of the Committee on Trauma and Emergency Preparedness at the ASA.
Finally, welcome, Dr. Sokol.
Hi, I'm Joe Sokol. I'm the Harris Family Foundation Chairman of Anesthesiology at North Shore University Health System, based in Chicago, Illinois. I'm a clinical professor at the University of Chicago, and I'm the ASA Chief Health Policy Officer.
Excellent. Thank you all so much. We appreciate you all being here to talk to us today. And I want to start today by talking about your personal stories so our listeners understand how deeply you've been impacted by the opioid problem. Especially you, of course, Dr. Milas. Can you tell our listeners a little more about your story?
Sure. I had already mentioned that I have lost, tragically, both of my sons. As an anesthesiologist, I think we have a unique opportunity in society to change the trajectory of the still ongoing opioid crisis to save lives and educate. You know, we as a group, we administer opioids. We know what an opioid overdose looks like. We also are well-versed at delivering Narcan and treating overdose. And additionally, we are experts at airways and rescue breathing. I think that this is a great opportunity for anesthesiologists to lead the charge to save lives lost to opioids.
And Dr. Dahl, you took a very different route, having been involved with an effort to save the lives of gunshot victims. Can you tell us a little bit about how that led you to your role in advocating for better solutions for the opioid crisis?
After the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting that resulted in loss of life due to bleeding, that Stop the Bleed campaign has been initiated. And this campaign, sort of spearheaded by the American College of Surgeons and Committee of Trauma, and they have train physicians to educate public how to apply tourniquet and stop loss of life due to hemorrhaging shock. So I've been involved with that education process. I'm one of the instructors. And as part of the Committee on Trauma and Emergency Preparedness, we sort of, most of our members are also educators. And we thought, we have a position and we have an opportunity to simulate the success of the Stop the Bleed campaign and perhaps do the similar public education and membership awareness around the opioid epidemic. And that involves use of Narcan and education of this resuscitation maneuver to public, such as schools, you know, our local communities, as well as during our annual meeting and so on.
And Dr. Sokol, give us a little bit about how you came to this topic.
So I really come to this topic from a policy point of view, recognizing this is a tremendous public health crisis. It's made worse during the COVID epidemic, and it's something that the ASA is very committed to helping to solve this issue and educate the public and improve patients' lives.
One of the many challenges with addiction is that it's very secretive. And I'm wondering, Dr. Miles, if you can talk a little bit about your own children's opioid addiction. Are there signs people should look out for? Are there specific things you really want people to know, like other parents or doctors?
Certainly, I would agree with you that addiction does start in secrecy and oftentimes remains there because of the shame and the stigma associated with it. Our children did not come to us saying, you know, mom and dad were struggling. Instead, it came by us as parents observing their behavior and being very attuned to inspecting things in their environment, particularly, say, in their bedroom. You know, I would often hear, say, when I was out to dinner with friends, that comments would be made like, I would always know if my child started to use drugs. You know, people who don't know that their children are using, it's because they're not paying close attention. But I can tell you, as an anesthesiologist, it was, even with my level of skill, it was difficult to detect because they started off doing things like, say, smoking pot or taking pills. And these were readily available in our local community. They're readily available in school. You could purchase Xannies or Xanax, OCs, OxyContin. It was available, and it started off very slow, very insidiously. So again, very hard to detect. But if you really were watching their behavior, you would become attuned to the fact that their moods would be sometimes erratic. Certainly, you could look at their pupils and see that they were either pinpoint or they were enlarged. But in particular, a behavior that we noticed was this kind of a what they would refer to as dipping out. And this would be somebody who would be falling asleep when they shouldn't be. They would be standing in front of the refrigerator looking for something to eat, and they would be leaning forward, falling asleep, holding onto the handles to keep them upright. Or they would be leaning forward into their dinner plate to the point where most of us, if your head kept falling, if you weren't impaired, you would jerk yourself upright and you'd shake it off. But this would be to the point where, you know, faces falling into their dinner plate. And obviously this came from using pills that were diverted locally into society, but it became very expensive, as for most people, to continue with that, paying $40, $60, $80 for an OxyContin that corresponded to the milligram dose. So then most individuals would escalate to heroin, which is very cheap. You can buy a small bag of heroin for $6. You can purchase a bundle of 10, obviously, for $60, the same amount that you could buy one pill of OxyContin. So the finances of it is frequently what drives people on to use intravenous heroin.
Can you talk a little bit about how a typical opioid addiction begins, or is there no typical?
Well, I would say that everyone's pathway into opioid addiction is probably different as to how they get there, but I think it would be safe to say it is atypical to go straight to using IV heroin. Oftentimes, it is during adolescence or young adulthood that they're exposing their still developing brain, which is, of course, a very dangerous time. And although they make a willing choice to use, everyone's propensity for addiction is somewhat different. And whether the first or second use, they experience an intense, amplified response that rapidly progresses to addiction, they then get to the point where the willingness to use and the willingness to stop is obliterated. They do not have the ability to control their use. And, you know, I think many people in society, stigma comes from the belief that an individual willingly chooses and can therefore willingly stop anytime they want. but that is clearly not the case, and that does not hold true with the science of addiction, of what we know.
Let's dig a little deeper into the science of this, into the science of opioid addiction. I'm wondering if you can tell us what happens to the brain and the body when someone becomes dependent, and how does that dependency translate into behaviors?
Well, once an individual's brain becomes opioid addicted, they require higher and higher amounts of that chemical, that drug in their system in order to feel the same endorphin high or the good feelings of that chemical. That's what we refer to as tolerance. If they do not use, then they will start to have symptoms of withdrawal. Typical things like becoming agitated, becoming very anxious. They start developing physical symptoms, goose flesh. They feel nauseous. They may start to vomit, have diarrhea. So physical symptoms that along with emotional distress. So they continue to use to avoid those negative symptoms and also to bring on that feeling of contentment, of warmth, the feeling that they are okay. And that continued need to use is, again, a financial burden. So that leads to the very negative behaviors of doing things like lying to your family members, stealing, and can also lead to criminal behavior. And in fact, just the ongoing use of a controlled substance is illegal in and of itself. And again, I believe that that contributes to stigma. The negative impression and the shame that is put on the individual who's using because of those negative behaviors.
Can I ask you, Dr. Dahl, how has Dr. Miles' experience and the experiences of so many other families like hers changed your practice? I mean, is there something that you do differently with this very painful knowledge in hand, something you want or think other anesthesiologists and other physicians that are listening should do as well?
So in 2010, there was about 38,000 people died, and gone up to double to 70,000 in 2017. At 2017, this issue has been recognized as an epidemic, and our surgeon, Dr. Adams, initiated five-step action plan to combat the epidemic. And these were including improving access and rehabilitation, increasing access to life-saving opioid overdose reversal drugs, such as naloxone, expanding public health surveillance of opioid use, so pain and addiction research, and finally promoting pain management programs and practices among caregivers. Since 2017, towards 2018, due to these initiatives, we start to see some drop in the numbers to 67,000 deaths occurred in that year. But the following year, 2019, according to the latest numbers, the death rate increased again significantly, almost to 71,000 people dying as a result of overdose. And, you know, I've been dealing with trauma all my professional life and looking at trauma numbers and deaths due to trauma. And according to the latest numbers, opioid overdoses are exceeding the car crash-related deaths in the United States currently. It has become really significant issue for all of us as physicians to help to combat. As I mentioned, I sort of do perioperative care improvement in my institute. We developed pathways of delivery. In those pathways, we developed special multimodal analgesia structure to have opioid use reduction while we are providing appropriate pain management care for the patients to satisfy them and get through the, you know, good recovery phase. So all these initiatives and opioid epidemic issue made us more aware the importance of education and restricted use of opioids and limited prescription practices and naloxone co-prescription when you are prescribing opioids for discharging patients. So these are the things that we took as an initiative in our hospital as physicians, and we are spending good amount of time to understand and meet the expectations, define them, and provide appropriate care.
From my end, in my practice personally, I usually take a few minutes as we're rolling into the operating room, away from family members. I'm with the patient, I'm close to their ear, we're putting on the non-invasive monitors, and I have a very honest discussion with them. Because of my personal experience, I know that substance use disorders are pervasive in the community. So I talk to them and I give them the freedom to tell me about their use habits. So in kind of a non-threatening manner, I ask them, quite frankly, tell me what you take at home to help you relax. And I give them a list of medications. Do you take Xanax, Ativan? Do you drink alcohol? 2 drinks a night? I listen to their responses. Then I take them further deep into this discussion, and I ask, many of my patients need to take pain medication for back pain or neck pain. Do you have a need to take medications such as Tramadol? And I go through a whole list of medication, oxycodone, OxyContin, Percocets. I listen to their response. Then I ask them whether they use recreational drugs. Do you smoke pot? Do you use cocaine? Do you use intravenous drugs such as heroin? And I tell them that, you know, I'm the individual who's responsible for a safe anesthetic and for making sure that they're comfortable. And this is why I'm asking these questions. So based on their response, I come up with a plan for intraoperative and postoperative pain relief. Additionally, if they have a need, I can make a referral. We have CRSs, which are certified recovery specialists, who will visit the patient in the hospital after surgery, and they will engage them in getting a recovery plan ready for them. So, you know, I find that just a bit of empathy and discussion, very honestly, people have shared some incredible things with me, and we've been able to get them on the right path, and certainly to keep them comfortable during and after surgery.
Do you have anything to add, Dr. Sokol?
I was going to talk about, you know, what happens with patients having surgery. And it used to be they would get a very large amount of opiates to take home to treat their post-operative pain, especially for orthopedic surgery. And we recognize that a portion of those patients, and they may become addicted to opiates. And as Dr. Dahl says, you know, anesthesiologists and surgeons are looking at other pharmacological ways, not using opiates, to help treat postoperative pain. So that's been an important shift in our mentality in medicine.
Excellent. And anesthesiologists, obviously, as you're saying, play such a critical role in pain management and the prescription of pain medication either before or following surgery. So I'd like to hear a little bit about other modalities beyond opioids for managing pain.
So there are really two ways to look at this. The non-opiate pain medications, acetaminophen, non-steroidal medications, and also the growing emphasis on doing regional anesthetic blocks to help patients with post-operative pain and giving them a period when their pain is really subdued because of the block and not needing opiates to treat that pain.
Are certain opioids more closely linked with addiction? Have they changed over time? And specifically, I'm kind of wondering if there are increased risks presented by the newer synthetic drugs.
Well, I can comment on the fact that certainly any opioid that has a very quick onset and quick offset, it has a tendency for higher abuse potential. But otherwise, I would say, you know, my addiction medicine specialist would probably be better able to comment on that. but I would like to make comments about fentanyl. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid. It does have that same profile of quick onset, quick offset. But what is being purchased on the street and what is particularly dangerous is the non-pharmaceutical fentanyl, which is typically the raw materials are brought in from outside the United States, from predominantly China. The drugs themselves are then manufactured often in Mexico and then brought across the border. This information comes to me from a DEA agent who recently spoke in the Philadelphia area. But fentanyl, the danger is twofold. One, that it is being oftentimes pressed into tablets and sold on the street as, say, counterfeit Xanax or cocaine. So the individual thinks that they're using one drug and they're actually using fentanyl. They are uninitiated and they rapidly overdose, leading to potentially to an overdose death. It's being mixed because it is cheap. It's not dependent on a poppy or an opium source. It's synthetic. So therefore, it's very cheap for a dealer to mix it in with heroin. So again, someone thinks they're using heroin, but it's actually fentanyl. So again, rapidly increasing the risk of overdose.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit here and talk about a really different drug. I want to talk about naloxone. What is it and how does it work?
Naloxone, it is the antidote to an opioid overdose. There is no other known use for this medication. It is commonly sold in the pharmacy, or you can get it at a health clinic as the nasal spray Narcan. It works by competitive inhibition at the mu receptor, which is the opioid receptor. It displaces and occupies the receptor such that it is able to restore consciousness and respirations or breathing in an individual who has overdosed. It takes approximately 2 to 3 minutes to work. You know, harkening back to the fentanyl epidemic that we're experiencing, fentanyl is considerably more potent, somewhere between 50 to 100 times more potent. And in being so, it takes oftentimes 2, 3, 4 doses of Narcan to reverse the overdose. And knowing that Narcan takes 2 to 3 minutes to work, then you can imagine at that time is adding up. So 2 to 3 minutes for each dose, and it takes multiple doses, particularly with fentanyl, that if the individual, the victim, is not breathing, that they will rapidly progress to either permanent brain injury or their heart is going to stop and it leads to death. With over 50% of overdoses occurring in the home, I think it is imperative that we have families who are at high risk of overdose, that they either have somebody with opioid use disorder in the home or they have an opioid prescription in the home, that they have the education and the Narcan. They know how to rescue breathe. That should be readily available in the home. Armand was mentioning the Stop the Bleed campaign. You will find the trauma packs next to the AED in public locations. I would like to see Narcan on the wall right next to that AED box, just like the Stop the Bleed. That should be readily available in the public.
I do want to spend a little bit of time on solutions like what you just referenced. Have there been efforts across the country from anesthesiologists and others that are really working? Are there some bright spots you guys can talk about?
Sure. I think, you know, probably Armand and Joe can speak to some of the efforts going on nationally. But what I can comment on is with the COVID epidemic, telemedicine has really exploded. That has allowed those individuals to have the ability to virtually connect with people who are struggling in order to help them get into treatment. It's also helpful to initiate, to start MAT, which is medication-assisted treatment, for those individuals who do not want to use heroin, who do not want to use opioids, that we could get them connected with using buprenorphine. Other things that are being developed and are actually in place right now is the concept of the warm handoff. So when an individual overdoses, the EMS squads and also emergency departments have individuals who will visit the victim who was overdosed and ask them, are you ready to stop using? Do you want help? And they assist in getting them into recovery rapidly, even to the point where potentially putting them in a cab and going with them to a treatment center for an assessment. So those are things that, again, are in place and are expanding.
Dr. Dahl, I'd love to ask you a little bit about federal and state regulations. How have the regulations around prescriptions and distribution of opioids changed?
Before going into answering that question, I just want to emphasize what Dr. Myers mentioned. There are three action items in the rule when they face an opioid overdose patient needs to be taken. So these are almost require simultaneous action with the help of others in around us when we observe such a patient or loved one. These are getting the emergency services alerted, providing breath and administration of naloxone. These are really critical steps into helping to bring somebody back while the help is arriving the emergency services. Out-of-hospital providers are now both in law enforcement as well as the paramedic programs have done enormous amount of work to recognize and help with this opioid overdose patient, as well as there is a national initiatives for limited opioid prescription. So we limit the number of days and number of doses the patient will be discharged from the hospital to take home with. Again, there are a lot of educational materials provided to the patients as part of this action plan, what to do with the medication and how to manage pain, as well as what to do with the medication they end up not using. If someone googles or searches on the internet to where is the opioid disposal stations are, many of the pharmacies and other locations are public to get rid of their medication without identification or anything. They can stop safely the medications they don't use, so that eliminates the accidental use of the opioid by the family members. In addition to that, I think state level, there are a lot of actions being into, first of all, identify the size of the problem, as well as initiatives like state medical directors have written standing orders for naloxone to be available without prescription for individuals, so we can go and get naloxone from any pharmacy without requiring special prescription. And there are a lot of educational and informative events going on. There are websites for each state, how they're tackling the opioid issue. And if we visit our state information board, and we will see what initiatives are taking place.
What are you seeing in Philadelphia, Dr. Miles?
I personally am involved in my local community, which is a suburb of Philadelphia. My local Bucks County Drug and Alcohol Commission, and of course there's alcohol commissions across the United States. I am involved with teaching naloxone rescue. So very basic discussions with the community members about how do you recognize an opioid overdose and the steps that they need to go through in order to get help as quickly as possible. I impress upon them that if you find your loved one down and collapsed, overdose, that they become an immediate responder. They are the only help that's available until help arrives. And I really drive home that issue. So I teach them, you call 911, you leave your cell phone out, keep it on speakerphone, and then that way you can use your hands and help the victim while you're speaking to the dispatcher. And it also gives you essentially a timestamp so that you know when you gave the dose of Narcan and you know when to give the next one. But again, the importance of having Narcan immediately available in the home, and also how to rescue breathe. We teach them how to rescue breathe, and the importance of if they don't know their family member's HIV or hepatitis status, to wear gloves. They can use a face shield. I teach them how to use a face shield or a face mask. And then, yes, if necessary, if they suspect that the individual does not have a heartbeat, where to put your hands and how to do chest compressions. These are all important things that are measures that we can best get these individuals to survive intact without brain injury, and again, to get them to accept recovery and to heal.
So let's talk a little bit about the ASA. What is the ASA doing about this?
Part of it is having podcasts such as this and having Dr. Mazindal speak at the annual meeting about this issue. There's something called the RX Summit, which they're going to have a presentation at talking about this issue. And having the Committee on Trauma and Emergency Preparedness really promoting this and trying to get to the local level. And a big part of this is, as mentioned before, is education and going to schools, going to churches, working with public health departments to get this information out with pamphlets and flyers. And then the other one is really to get the ability people get ready access to nasal naloxone, because that, you know, rescue breathing is important, but again, nasal naloxone is really the gold standard for treatment of opiate overdose.
Dr. Miles, I wonder if you'd like to add anything.
Well, again, I think public education is the key. We need to pair the naloxone or the Narcan with basic life support maneuvers. I think that that's where the ASA has the opportunity to really make a dramatic impact in society. And again, the message that I drive home with community members is they understand I'm an anesthesiologist. I have a level of expertise, but I teach them and I make it the point that you do not need to be a doctor or a healthcare worker to save your loved one or a community member. You just need to have the drug available. You need to call 911 and you need just some basic skills. And quite honestly, you know, hearkening to what Joe was saying is, personally, I think that rescue maneuvers and how to help an individual, not just somebody who's overdosed, but just having basic life support skills, that is essentially a part of being a good citizen. And it should be taught in high schools and probably even lower down in middle schools. That if you're not helping an overdose victim, well, you may be helping your grandmother who's had a heart attack. So the pairing of Narcan with basic rescue maneuvers is important in overdose, but I think it is even more widespread. Just basic skills, it's part of good citizenship.
What can our listeners do to make sure they are giving their patients as much help as they can?
The one thing I would also say, so we can treat the opiate overdose victim with Narcan and rescue breathing, but as Dr. Maz was referring to earlier, it's important to follow up with patients and having adequate treatment centers and resources available for persons interested in getting over their addiction and helping to achieve that. Because all we're going to do is keep repeating this cycle and trying to rescue people. We need to get to the root causes first.
Okay, so consider yourself talking to the 54,000 ASA members. What do you want them to do?
This is a grassroots movement, and we want every member of the ASA to take action. And if they have any ideas or any thoughts about how to participate or what to do, reach out to us.
I would say first and foremost is to recognize the pain and the difficulties that all families that are dealing with opioid use disorder, what they are going through. And, you know, from a personal standpoint, I want you to consider, really think about what it's like when, say, for instance, I would get up in the middle of the night for whatever reason, and the first thing that I would do is I would open my son's door, make sure that he was breathing, make sure that he wasn't face down on the bathroom floor overdosing, that many families across the United States, that's what they live with every day. And I'd really like you to take that to heart, to internalize that and recognize that that suffering is ongoing. It is a pervasive societal problem right now. And what you can do is, as a community member, to really embrace the call to arms that we're really asking for you to think about doing right now, is to have conversations out in your communities, and also to be public educators, to really know that you can make a difference and it doesn't take very much in terms of effort.
What role does stigma play in all this?
You know, I've spoken about the issue of stigma. I think that that is perhaps the biggest barrier in society that prevents individuals from seeking treatment because they are shamed. And it also limits the family from beginning to heal. They don't necessarily want to present for treatment, the family and the individual. So again, I think that as healthcare providers, as anesthesiologists, that we can, as individuals, if we can start having conversations in public spaces, like at PTA meetings, on the soccer fields, when you're out to dinner with friends, is to lean into their conversations, and you can dispel untruths. You can educate people just very informally. It really doesn't take much time or energy to do that. And to, again, to educate others. People like myself, and there are other anesthesiologists who have also suffered losses, if we share our stories, that we can humanize opioid addiction, that it's not just a marginalized individual that's affected. It is all of us. It is all of our loved ones, your neighbors that are affected. And by removing barriers to treatment, or by just improving attitudes in society, that will allow us to treat opioid use disorder and substance use disorder, and in fact, any mental health disorder, with empathy. And it will also allow us to start treating it as if it is any other medical disorder, with the same research dollars and the same passion behind it.
That was beautifully said, Dr. Milas. I think that is the perfect place to leave it. I want to thank all three of you for joining us today, for your information that you've shared. Dr. Milas, for your personal story especially. We appreciate your time. It was a real pleasure. And I'm sure our listeners learned a ton here as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Central Line. Please join us again next time.
Access resources developed by ASA in partnership with the AAOS to help reduce perioperative pain and encourage optimal opioid stewardship. View the Pain Alleviation Toolkit at asahq.org/pain-toolkit. Subscribe to Central Line today wherever you get your podcasts, or visit asahq.org/podcasts for more.